Well, it is a blessing to be here this morning. We greet you all in Jesus' name. I think I'm going to feel a little bit like Victor. I was in Michigan last week for the rotating schedule with the Daystar Conference and thought about bringing that message here of studying through the women in Jesus' life and had a message on Mary Magdalene. Hopefully you had an Easter message here, and I felt like I was led to preach something different than that, but like I say, I'm glad to be here this morning and to worship together with you. Well, to start out the message this morning, I thought about bringing a few children's blocks along and stacking them up here on the corner of the podium and then just knocking them over. As an illustration, we see times when children do this. And you can picture this. I don't need to bring blocks along. You've seen it many times where children build up a little pyramid, or maybe they just make one tall stack up in a row and they have it and it keeps getting taller and taller. And there's several things that could happen. It could just fall over because, well, that last little block just didn't get put in place, or maybe in most cases it seems like a brother or sister just comes along and knocks it over, and maybe someone just accidentally bumped into it, or it just got unstable at some point. And the end result's the same. The tower is down, everything's destroyed, and they're heartbroken about it. And you have some options at that point. You can start over, or you can just walk away and give up. And I'm just thinking about, we put a lot of dedication, a lot of time into building up our little tower, and then it all falls over. And what do we do with it? Now, I know that some of you children memorize the poem, Builders and Wreckers, and before, I think this fits very well with the message, and hopefully you can help me out and say this along with me, because I was at your school program. I know you learn it. So, if you know it and you want to help out, it doesn't matter whether you were in the school program or not. As I watched them tear a building down, a gang of men in a busy town, with a heave and a hoe and a lusty yell, they swung a beam and a sidewall fell. I asked the foreman, "Are these men skilled and the men you'd hire if you wanted to build?" And he gave a laugh and said, "No, indeed, just common labor is all I need. I can easily wreck in a day or two what builders have taken years to do." And I thought to myself as I went my way, which of these roles have I tried to play? Am I a builder who works with care, measuring life by rule and square? Am I shaping my work to a well-made plan, patiently doing the best I can? Or am I a wrecker who walks the town content with the labor of tearing down? O Lord, let my life and labors be that which build for eternity. You all must have forgot it. I did it myself. Anyway, for the message this morning, I want to look at the life of Nehemiah, and the title for the message this morning is Rebuilding Broken Walls, and I want to look at this in relation to church life. I really liked what was brought out in the Sunday school lesson here at the end about opposition many times is successful when it comes from within, and many times it's so easy that in relationships and situations that someone offends us by their words or by their actions, and maybe they spread a rumor about us, or maybe we heard something about someone and we passed it along and it hurt someone, or maybe someone was really too blunt with us about a real issue that we had in our life, some area that we needed to grow, and they didn't go about it in quite the way we thought they should have, and we're a little bit offended, and we have to deal with that in some way. Or there's just so many things. You fill in the blank on things that have broken a relationship. Someone that you thought was your friend and suddenly they're not your friend. Or someone that you cared about and they didn't like you for some reason and you thought that it was a friendship. Well, Jesus says that offenses will come and things do happen. We're humans. We make mistakes. But what will we do when our tower crumbles? And that's the real question for this morning. And before we get into the message, I do want to give, I don't believe in disclaimers all the time, but I do believe that this message deserves a few disclaimers. Number one, I would say I'm embarrassed to admit that I've done my share of wrecking. I have not always been the builder that I want to be, and I want to do better at that. And number two is that I do not have all the answers, but thankfully the Bible And I think about this. God wrote this manual. This is like the operator's manual right here. You can pick it up and say, okay, how do we deal in this situation? And there is a verse in there that talks about the human life and how our spirit and how our soul is created and what makes us tick and what will fix it. So there's answers here. The Bible does have the answers. I don't. Another point in disclaimers is I'm not coming down here, and this is one of the privileges of coming to here versus preaching this at Keysville, is that I don't have any specific situation or agenda that I'm aware of in your church that I'm coming here to straighten you all out. So you can relax or maybe sit up and pay attention in a different way than think I'm speaking specifically to you. And I do believe our churches are unified in a large majority, but I was thinking about the opposition that comes from within that was mentioned in the Sunday school and how often it's really the devil's kind of looking and says, there, if I can get right in this spot, then I can blow this whole thing wide open. I can get in there and I can make an issue over this little wee thing over here. All it takes, it's like you remember the story of the fella that stuck his finger in the dike. You probably remember that from school. All it takes is that little wee pinhole to start breaking apart and the whole dam comes down and the town is flooded. Well, we need to be vigilant. We need to be proactive and on the offense. We need to be going out and watching out for these kind of things. And I just think about how many congregations they're where we're having church, where you're having church. Something happened. Yes, okay, maybe they only had one child or two, and maybe they moved out of the area and whatever, and this church disappeared because of that. But in many cases, it's because, well, I didn't like that the new preacher that they got in. They hired a new guy, and he was not like the old fellow that had a heart of compassion. He was all worried about the money and the big sanctuary or whatever it was. Or you fill in the blank. Somehow, unity probably did not happen is the reason that this church was available for you to purchase. And the same thing happened at Keysville. It was called the United Church of Christ. Well, people disagreed and went their ways, and they weren't very united. So it can happen so quickly. It can be leadership issues, and people, well, okay, here's some issues that we need to deal with, or taking sides on some unresolved issues between two brothers. Well, half the congregation feels this way, and half the congregation feels another way. And it can just be so many different things, and a lot of these things are caused by pride and selfishness and stubbornness and independent attitude. No one's going to tell me what to do. And accusations and rumors start to fly, and the wall's broken down. And what do we do next? Well, in this age of Google, we look up things and we see what it has to say once in a while. And out of curiosity, I wondered what AI had to say about this. And this is the answer. According to the world. Actually, they hit it pretty close, but I'll read it. Effective conflict resolution involves understanding and managing emotions, facilitating discussions, and increasing mutual understanding. Healthy conflict resolution strategies include empathizing with other person's viewpoint, reacting calmly and respectfully, and being willing to forgive and move past the conflict. Unhealthy responses such as explosive reactions, withdrawing love, and inability to compromise can escalate conflicts and harm relationships. It's kind of interesting, just a different perspective on some of the things I have to share this morning. Let's start in Nehemiah chapter 1. I have 9 points for this morning. Most of them are rather short, but in the book of Nehemiah, we have people here that living with broken down walls. The walls had all come down, and they had lived with this for decades, it appears. I did not actually go back and research when the walls came down and exactly when Nehemiah built them. That's really beside the point. Let's start here with Nehemiah 1, verses 6 and 7. And this point is introspection. The very first thing we need to do is kind of analyze where we are at, get a proper perspective of ourselves in the situation. And this is where Nehemiah says, and we could even start back a little further. He said, I beseech thee, O Lord God, this is chapter 1, verse 5. of heaven, and the great and terrible God that keepeth covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. Let thine ear now be attentive and thy eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now day and night for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Both I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments which thou commandest thy servant Moses. So in introspection, we need to kind of look into ourselves. We can look out and we can point fingers at everyone else, and it's all their fault that I'm in this situation. But in most cases, it ends up that we have a part to play in it. And you could say, well, Nehemiah really didn't. He wasn't the sinner out of this situation. He wasn't the one that had a problem. It was his parents, his grandparents. It was somebody else. He could have blamed and pointed fingers at someone else. But he says, we have sinned. We have forsaken the God of our fathers. And he saw that he was taking part, taking some responsibility on himself. And sometimes we have people that do too much introspection. They blame themselves for everything, and they have a guilt complex, and they, well, it's probably me. It's probably my fault. We're not talking about that. We're talking about situations where people don't do enough self-examination in a quiet moment. Think about what I said, what I did, and this is where I need to be sometimes. I've said some things, done some things that I should have thought twice before saying them, and I'd stop and think about it. And we also need to realize that some people are more easily offended, and maybe we did say it in a way that they couldn't accept. I do also think on this one, on ourselves especially, in this introspection, and I guess you could look at this on other people as well, but in introspecting, if I look at my own life, where I'm hurt is when my pride is hurt. The taller our tower, we built our big tower up here, and we're up here on top of the pal somewhere. We've got it figured out, and somebody kicks the prop out from underneath us, and we're offended because we were a little bit too arrogant, possibly. And maybe it was time that we did get knocked down a little bit. Number two is confess your part to God in prayer. And this, of course, kind of goes along. We're there at verse 7. Where he's saying, we have dealt corruptly. These two kind of run together a little bit. But we go on down here. He's continuing his prayer. Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if you transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if you turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out unto the uttermost part of heaven, yet will I gather thee from thence, and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name there. Now these are thy servants and thy people, whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and thy strong hand. O Lord, I beseech thee, now let thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant, to the prayer of thy servants, who desire to fear thy name, and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. So after we've kind of analyzed our life, and then we need to pray about it, and we need to let God give us the answers, and that's where he was at right the moment. He knew that God could prosper them. He knew that God could bring them success in this whole situation. And he confessed his part to God in prayer. And God has the solution. He specializes in restoration. I just think about how much you can keep your finger here or a marker, whatever, in Nehemiah, but how much God says that he wants to restore his people and build them up. And in Matthew 18, we generally go there on how to fix problems. But the verses here in Matthew 18 I want to look at that come right ahead of how to deal with offenses is the story of the lost sheep. And that is Matthew 18, verse 12. What think ye, if a man have 100 sheep and one of them be going astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seek that which is going astray? And if so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. And then he goes on to say, moreover, if thy brother trespass against thee. But we just see that God really wants restoration to happen. He is willing to go out of his way to make an accommodation, to find the lost soul, to bring them back, and to bring them back into the fold, to build up his church. and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He doesn't want anyone to perish. Number four is to have a plan, and we're going to go right back to Nehemiah, and we'll stay there most of the morning. And that is to have a plan. So we see Nehemiah coming here in chapter 2, verse 6 and 7. When the king started asking him what's going to happen, he had already thought through. He had a little plan of action put in place. He didn't know how it was going to turn out, but he at least knew what he was going to say for the first step. The king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come to Judah. And then we can go on down here in verse 12, verse 17 and 18. Verse 12 says, I arose in the night, and some few men with me, neither told I any man which was what God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me save the beast I rode on. And then in verse 17 and 18 says, then said I unto them, ye see the distress we are in Jerusalem. Wait. Ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's word that he had spoken to me. And they said, rise up, let us build. And they strengthened their hands for this good work. My point is, Nehemiah had a plan, and then he had some... Once he had put together a few basic things, he shared his plan and his vision of what he saw as a way to get back to a wall that was rebuilt with the people around him. And it was people that had the same vision. Well, I shouldn't say that. They didn't have the vision because they walked around all the stones that were falling down for all this time. But he inspired them. He said, we can do better. We can do better. We don't have to deal with people sitting in the back not talking to the four benches up front, or the people that avoid each other in the hallway or whatever. We don't have to live like this. We can get along. We can find some solutions. And we see here, my next point is the enemy's trying to discourage you before you even get started. And we see that in verse 19. They hadn't even put the first stone together. And it says, but when Sanballat the Hornite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite and Gershom the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that you will do? Will you rebel against the king? So the enemy is always in our life, planting doubts, trying to get us to think all these things. And you've felt these things before. I don't think I'm the only person. You say, well, this is a waste of time. Just forget it. It's not going to work. It's not a good plan. We're not going to be successful. Why waste our time going talking to this person or saying something to this person? It's just going to make the situation even worse because it's just going to get heated and we're not going to get anywhere. He's going to be still feeling the same way and I'm still going to be feeling the same way and we're not going to get anywhere. Or the other one that the enemy tells us is that time will heal. It's like, okay, if we just ignore it, he'll get over it, I'll get over it, and we'll just go on the way it is. Or the other one that we get sometimes is we say, well, let's tell three of our friends how badly I was hurt and how terrible it is, and maybe they'll sympathize with me. But if we go back to Matthew 18, we see that that is not the way to deal with issues. It says, when you have an offense, the very first thing is the person that's hurt must go by themselves to the other person that they have a problem with, share them what hurt them, and start from there. Too many times we like to jump to step three and go tell someone else and have them take care of our problems for us. But it's really the person that's hurt going, and you can study into that. You can... I don't want to get too distracted here from the story of Nehemiah, but telling others, unless you're in step two where you need to take a brother or two with you, is not the way to start rebuilding. And number six would be just to get to work. These people We're here. They have walked around these broken walls all this time. It wasn't going, God's not going to magically fix anything for you. Very rarely. Okay, so the lame man did get healed by God's Spirit. I'm not saying that can't happen. I'm just saying in relationships, it's just going to take work. It's not going to automatically happen. And he got the people inspired there in verse 18 where they said, let's rise up, and they strengthened their hands for the good work. Let's get to it. And then I could have read the whole book of Nehemiah, but we don't have time this morning. Chapter 3, verse 1 starts out the chapter saying, then Eliab the high priest rose up with his brethren, the priest, and they build the sheep gate, and they sanctify it and set up the doors of it, even in the tower of Maah. They sanctified it under the tower of Hananiel. And then we go clear down to the end of the chapter here at verse 31. After him repaired Melchiah, the goldsmith's son, unto the place of the Nethinims and of the merchants over against the gate of Mipked, and to the going up of the corner, and between the going up of the corner and to the sheep gate repaired the goldsmiths and the merchants. So if you would follow that through, essentially that's coming full circle. I'm going to say 2.5 mile of wall around the city of Jerusalem. So big section, everybody's building on their piece. Everybody's working together. There's a lot of work to do. And I guess the part that I should have pointed out before we even read the verses is we have everybody from the priest to the goldsmiths working at this. And too many times the devil likes to divide us. And one of the ways that he does is says, well, those are the old people or those young people. And it's like, they're rich or they're poor or these people are wise and these people are unlearned, as we studied about in Sunday school this morning. Or this is a loud group of people over here and this fella here is too shy. And somehow we feel like we fit perfectly in the middle. We're not too old. We're not too young. 40 is just kind of perfectly in the middle there. And I'm not super wealthy, but I have a few dollars in my bank account, so I'm not rich or poor. And we feel like we've got it right in the middle. But but the point is that Satan divides us by class, and he says, well, we can't. But these people, they got the priests, they got the goldsmiths, they had these ladies to help them with their dad here on one section of the wall, all these different people. There were a few people that didn't show up to the work, but pretty much everyone was pulling together, and it brought them some unity. And we see in here that they were putting their effort where their talents were. So you have some people that were talented at some people were doing the corners, some people were doing the gates, some people were doing the bars and the locks, and other people were doing the wall. So everybody was pitching in as they could. And along with that, getting to work, is that they had a positive attitude. They said they strengthened their hands. They got busy. They said, we can do this. We're going to have a positive outcome. This is not going to go south. We're just not going to let it happen. And there are many different ways that we can get to work and rebuild relationships. Like I've mentioned, obviously one of the things is going and sitting down with a person that's offended us, or the person that's offended comes to us. And maybe I've been the offender, and this is coming from that. But for the offender, when someone comes to you and says, okay, I was really hurt by what you said yesterday or last month or whatever, it's really hard to just sit there and be quiet and listen. And so many times, maybe I'm speaking for myself, and I know I'm speaking for at least one or two of you, I would think, that so many times you want to say, but this is why I said that, and I didn't mean this, and you took it the wrong way, and what's going on here? But it really doesn't. So many times I just want to do that. But it's hard to just sit still, be quiet, listen and hear the person out. And then most of the time, just say you're sorry. And the issue there is, this happens to me too. Maybe I'm just revealing myself here this morning. But we say, I'm sorry, but, and then the sorry didn't mean a thing because we added the but and we had an excuse at the end that just undid everything we had to say. Just say you're sorry. That'll fix it probably better. And then just be quiet or find a positive thing to say. Like I say, I don't have all the answers. So maybe it will work out differently for you. But saying I'm sorry and adding some clause or disclaimer behind it is not going to help, I can tell you that. The next part about getting to work is physically working together. So these people were out on a common goal. They had a common thing in mind. And yes, sometimes half the people you say, hey, we have a church project. We'd really help with church cleaning. And there are about three or four families that you pretty much know are probably not going to show up. And you're doing all the work. That didn't happen here quite as much. There were some nobles that didn't put their necks to the work. And that can be discouraging. But the people that do show up can bless each other in a way and build brotherhood in a way that I don't think just sitting down on a Sunday afternoon does the same thing on building unity. Maybe I'm wrong. But they had 52 days of hard work, laboring for the same goal. They were pulling together. They had one goal in mind, and everybody was super focused on that goal for 52 days. That was all they did. They didn't do anything else. There was barely time for anything, and it pulled them together in a way that I don't think it would have otherwise. And unity is not built by everyone doing their own thing. In the modern Christianity, the thought is that, well, God's speaking to you in this way, and the Spirit's leading me to do this, and I've got this revelation in my life, and if the Spirit doesn't convict you about this certain issue, well, then it's really not a problem, and maybe you can be convicted. There's a little wee bit of room for that, for people to grow in their. But unity comes in people blending their lives, blending their understanding of Scripture together, and working toward a common goal, not everybody meeting in four walls and having completely different concepts of doctrine and religion. But working together toward a common goal. And like we said, some do better at some things than others, and maybe working toward a common goal. Some of you are putting together and planning a church picnic, and you're really good at planning for fellowship meal or whatever it is, and you find people that fit together in committee work, and it's just very interesting to me. You serve on something like a school board or an outreach committee or something. You find what people are passionate about, and it helps you understand their worldview and what they care about, what they believe in, and you can benefit from each other. And learning to know people just more personally than just shaking their hand on a Sunday morning. I remember one of our customers came in the store one day. She lives right across from my in-laws. And so she was fairly close there. And she said, you know, Curtis, she said, I really didn't like you the first couple times I came in. She said, but now that I've gotten to know you, she said, I love your family. I am so sad that you moved over to Thurmont. I said, well, Mary, come on over sometime. You can come over to our house. We'll, have lunch with us or something. Well, she's getting a little old, and that's pretty far for her to drive. She might get one of her friends to come over. But after we learned to know each other, I probably felt the same way about her. I don't remember that. There's hundreds of customers that come in. But the fact of the matter is, the more you learn to know each other, the better it typically goes. And then the other thing is focusing on the positive. You can choose to focus on the negative, and you'll have a miserable life. You can just be stuck in a rut and just say, well, yeah, it's just life is terrible. And this discourages me some days. I drive around. I'm in the business that I'm in. Now I get into different stores and see. And the huge difference between success and failure is not that somebody's super intelligent. And you've seen this. The people that have high IQs and got good grades in school were bankrupt, and the people that barely could string a sentence together are multimillionaires. It just, the point is not that at all, but people's outlook and saying, you know what, this didn't work out. Tomorrow's a new day. I'm going to start fresh. I'm going to start over and focus on the positive. So there are just so many times where if we can look for the good in others and be open to other people's perspectives and try to see the way they're perceiving things will benefit us. The seventh one I have is being on guard against the enemy. And we see that here in chapter 4, verse 22 and 23. Like I say, the enemy's looking for any little crack he can, and they found out about it, and they were ready. Here in 22 and 23, it says, "Likewise, at the same time I said unto the people, let everyone with his servants lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard unto us and labor on the day. So neither I nor my brethren nor my servants nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, save that everyone put them off for washing." So the issue is, on being guard against the enemy, here's what I see in this little piece. And that is, the enemy loves to strike at night. So we get to bed, and we're thinking about, really wonder what he meant when he said that. And and we get into our house, and one house, he's like, the person over here in this house, person A, is saying, is he really sorry? He told me he was sorry, but is he really sorry? And the other fella saying, he said he forgave me, but was he serious about it? And we start to second guess, and the enemy's right there, and he's just ready to drive that wedge back in again. And if that doesn't work, Satan will try more tricks. We see this down here in chapter 6. Fake news is not new to 2024 or whatever year you want to say that it started in. This was a thing clear back then. Nehemiah 6, verse 5 to 9, we see this whole story. We're running out of time here. I won't read every verse here, but where Sanballat made up this big story that it's reported among the heathen that you're thinking to rebel, and that's why you're building the wall, that you could be a king, that Nehemiah really wanted to be a king. It was all fake. And he said, there's no such things that thou sayest. So we need to kill these rumors and not focus on these things, that these doubts and these fake things that are out there trying to deceive us. And kind of along with that is good communication. We can start to second guess people. And we see that here in Nehemiah 4, verse 19 and 20. They needed to have a way of knowing when the other person was in distress. It says here in verse 19, I said unto the nobles and the rulers and the rest of the people, the work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. And we talked about this. So we're talking 3/4 of a mile between the people on this corner and the people over here on the other corner that were working. They needed to have a way of communicating. In what place, therefore, ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort hither to us, for our God shall fight for us. So if we know what's going on, we don't need to be suspicious. We have good communication. We don't need to second guess other people's motives and be suspicious. Why did they put it that way? What did they mean by this? If we're openly communicating those things, the enemy doesn't have a foothold to get in. And another part of this communication is when we get that distress signal. So they blew the trumpet. There's a problem over here. We get a brother that comes running from his side of the wall, and he comes over and here says, hey, I understand you've got a problem. Can I help? Is there something that I can help with? We go running, and we give him a boost, and we say, oh, it's not so bad. It's going to be all right. You'll make it through. And then when you call for help, you blow the trumpet over here. They come running your way. And that's what brotherhood's about. He returns the favor and helps you see it in a little different perspective. And we can rebuild. Well, when the wall is built, the last part is that God receives the honor and glory here. In Nehemiah 6, verse 16, we have this verse that says, and it came to pass when our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived this work was wrought of our God. And really, there is, just to recap a few things, the children of Israel had accepted these broken down walls, and they had accepted defeat. They thought the defeat was just, or to put it in our day, dysfunctional church life is just the way when you have people together, there's always going to be this tension and issues going on. And the second part that I see here, just in recapping, is when the walls were broken down, they were completely at the mercy of the enemy. The enemy could get them down at any moment he wanted to because it was open. There was no holding back. The trust was completely gone, and any time that he wanted to start a fight, it was simple. But Nehemiah took his positive attitude. He inspired the people. He completed the wall in record time. The enemy was foiled because they stuck up for each other. They said, you know what? I don't believe that about Sherwin. I don't believe that about Ike. I don't believe that about Dennis. You can tell me it's fake news. You made it up. You're trying to read things into what they said, and it's not true. And they defended each other. And when this all happened, the people around them had to admit that God was the source. And if my desire for each of you is to be a builder in the wall, that maybe you're good at doors and locks, and maybe your brother is good at masonry, and you make this thing work, you fit it together. And I've just got two verses here in closing on unity. And the one is from John 17, verse 21. And this was Jesus' prayer for the church. And this is the verse that says, well, we'll just read it. John 17, verse 21. That they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. There's a powerful witness when people are unified, because this doesn't happen. This is not, what do you want to say? It doesn't occur in the wild. This is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. And we see also that when we're unified and working together, there's nothing the enemy can do. There's one more verse in Numbers 23, verse 23. And this is just where we want to be. God is defending us, and people see it. And it's not that we get the honor and glory. And this is in the story of Balaam. It says, surely there is no enchantment against Jacob. There's nothing that you can do against God's people that's going to prevail when they're serving the Lord. Neither is there any divination against Israel. According to this time, it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought? Will God say that about your church? Let's pray.